Do you have an insatiable curiosity about the world? Do you find yourself provoking conversations with your friends and coworkers? Are you a strong listener? Then you should consider applying to become the next host of A Public Affair, WORT's daily hour-long call-in talk program. We're now accepting applications for this volunteer position. The next host will be the voice of Tuesday's show and join a stellar lineup of folks who engage listeners in conversations on social, cultural, and political issues of importance every day of the week. We're looking for someone who is curious and well-informed, comfortable speaking on air, someone who can think on their feet and has at least 5 hours a week to prepare and host the show. And of course, we'll need you to be here every Tuesday from 12 to 1 p.m. Apply by May 2nd. To find out more information or apply, go to wortfm.org/talkhost.
This is Danielle Jaworowiecka with the BBC News. Hello. Britain's Supreme Court has ruled that the legal definition of a woman is based on biological sex. The government said the decision brought clarity and confidence for women and service providers such as hospitals, refuges and sports clubs. The case was brought by women's rights campaigners over the Scottish government's interpretation of conflicting legislation on transgender women. The judges said the rights of transgender people would not be affected by the ruling. Patrick Hodge is the court's deputy president.
The correct interpretation of the EA as referring to biological sex does not cause disadvantage to trans people. Trans people have the rights which attach to the protected characteristic of gender reassignment.
Iran has insisted its right to continue enriching uranium for its nuclear program is non-negotiable. The comment comes before Tehran's second round of talks with Washington and a visit by the head of the UN's nuclear watchdog. Mike Thompson reports.
Iran's insistence that its right to enrich uranium is non-negotiable threatens to derail hopes of a deal with Washington. It comes a day after the US said that its demand that Tehran stops all enrichment is equally non-negotiable. Tehran has repeatedly insisted that its nuclear program is only for peaceful purposes, but its increasing enrichment of uranium to near weapons-grade levels doesn't support that. President Trump has threatened to bomb Iran if no deal is reached.
German prosecutors have charged a doctor in Berlin with the murder of 15 of his patients. He's also accused of setting fire to 5 of their homes to cover his tracks. Here's Paul Moss.
What's alleged is that this doctor went to their homes to treat people and injected them with a lethal cocktail of drugs, a muscle relaxant initially, and then he injected them with an anaesthetic. He was arrested last August when 4 deaths were found to be suspicious, but then the investigation expanded and they've basically been looking through the records of all the people who died who were being treated by this doctor. What they say is at the moment there are 395 deaths which they're looking at.
Member states of the World Health Organization have agreed on the text of a legally binding treaty designed to strengthen global collaboration on any future pandemic. The agreement is the culmination of years of negotiations following the COVID-19 outbreak. The treaty has been overshadowed by the US withdrawal from the WHO and the loss of its significant funding. The European Union has published a list of 7 countries it considers safe after coming under pressure to help member states speed up migrant returns. The tightening of asylum rules will apply to Kosovo, Bangladesh, Colombia, Egypt, India, Morocco and Tunisia. The EU hopes the change will address what it calls a significant backlog of asylum applications. You're listening to the latest world news from the BBC.
Attention WORT volunteers and donors. WORT is holding an election for 2 open participating member seats and 1 open listener sponsor seat to serve 3-year terms on the board of directors of Back Porch Radio Broadcasting, Inc., with terms beginning at the annual meeting in June and concluding at the annual meeting in June 2028. Financial acumen, computer literacy, and a willingness to work within a dynamic group to help shape this great station are all desirable qualifications. People of underrepresented groups are strongly encouraged to apply. Some committee hours are required outside of board meetings. Applications must be received by 5 p.m. on Thursday, May 15th to ensure consideration. Voting begins Thursday, May 29th and continues until the annual meeting on Sunday, June 29th. More information and board applications are available at wordfm.org or on paper in the station lobby. Help us keep WORT a vibrant and important part of our community. Apply today.
Do you care about workers and labor issues? Do you want to make a difference in our community for working people? Then join the Labor Radio team. Labor Radio is a weekly show that covers labor, social justice, and political issues that impact workers. And we need your help. As a Labor Radio volunteer, you will have the opportunity to report on important labor and social justice stories in your community, interview workers, activists, and experts, produce and edit your own stories. No prior experience is necessary, though a connection with labor is a plus. We will provide training and support. All you need is a passion for worker justice and a desire to amplify the voices of working people. To learn more, contact Volunteer Coordinator Adrian Rainey at 608-321-9583 or head online to WORTFM.org/volunteer to fill out an application. Labor Radio, a voice for workers.
Support for this program comes from Orange Tree Imports, locally owned at 1721 Monroe Street in Madison for almost 50 years. Orange Tree Imports offers a wide array of gifts and kitchenware, including cookware, toys, specialty foods, and Wisconsin products. Information and store hours are available at orangetreeimports.com.
Good morning. It is Wednesday, April 16th, and this is the 8 o'clock buzz. I'm Jan Miyasaki. This morning, I'll be speaking with Jadine Sanada. Jadine Sanada is campaign coordinator at the Wisconsin chapter of the Sierra Club. So the mission of the club is to explore, enjoy, and protect the wild places of the earth, and to practice and promote the responsible use of the Earth's ecosystems and resources. So the Sierra Club accomplishes these goals through direct and grassroots legislative and administrative lobbying, education, outings, litigation, and electing environmental champions to local, state, and federal office. And they are a member agency of Community Shares of Wisconsin. So stay tuned to hear from Jadine Sanada. Also, I'll be speaking with Marco Aguirre, a member of Madison Arcatel Sister City Project, an American citizen originating from El Salvador. Aguirre continues to stay closely in touch with Salvadoran politics through a variety of media and personal connections. And we'll take a deeper view of U.S.-El Salvador relations and the crisis it represents. And then later from Wart News, yesterday's program, protesters staged tax day sit-in at the state capitol. So stay tuned to the program. We'll be right back.
Georgia, Georgia, the whole day through, just an old sweet song keeps Georgia on my mind.
Georgia on my mind.
I said a Georgia, Georgia, a song of you comes as sweet and clear as moonlight through the pines. Other arms are out to me, other eyes smile tenderly, still in the peaceful dreams I see, the road leads back to you. I said, Georgia,
Oh, Georgia, no peace.
It is 10 minutes after 8, and here with me in the studio is Jadeen Sanada. She is campaign coordinator at the Wisconsin chapter of the Sierra Club. And the mission of the Sierra Club is to explore, enjoy, protect. I like how you say you write the wild places of the earth, and to practice and promote the responsible use of the earth's ecosystems and resources. And they accomplish these goals through direct and grassroots legislative and administrative lobbying, education, ODINs, litigation, and electing environmental champions to local and state and federal office. And the Wisconsin chapter of the Sierra Club is a member agency of Community Shares Wisconsin. And welcome, Jadeen. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
So for folks who just may not be familiar with the Sierra Club and the Wisconsin chapter, can you talk about the history of this club? It's one of the oldest, right?
Yeah. So our Sierra Club chapter here in Wisconsin is part of the National Sierra Club organization. We've been around for a long time. And here the chapter started, I believe, in 1963. And so we have been doing work across the state since then, through local groups and through some various issue campaigns that we focus a lot on, with a bunch of volunteers that do amazing, just like incredible work to advocate for, you know, safer climate and a clean environment and things like that.
And so you have members and you have chapters, right?
Yeah, so our organization is member-based, and then our chapters are kind of like how our work gets housed and organized. And so our members and volunteers come in through the chapter and do work through, you know, whatever avenue they choose to, either locally or with the statewide team.
So the campaigns that are led by this and organized by the Sierra Club, can you talk about the campaigns that you work on?
Yeah, I work on a couple different things. We've got a lot going on and always looking for more people. So if anyone's interested, I would welcome you to come learn some more. But I work on some water issues around nitrates and PFAS. And I work on electric sector issues. But the thing that I'm really excited to share about today, if we've got some time, is our work to shut down Line 5 and protect the Great Lakes from the tar sands oil pipeline Line 5. This is a big pipeline. It's owned by a Canadian company, Enbridge, and it cuts across Wisconsin. In particular, it is operating right now illegally on the Bad River Band Reservation. And we've been doing a lot of work to make sure that this pipeline doesn't threaten tribal sovereignty, treaty rights, climate, and just the many waterways, including Lake Superior, that could potentially be impacted by a spill or construction.
Can you kind of give us an update on that issue? Have things changed since January, for instance, since the new administration?
That's a good question. Obviously, we have concerns about how the federal administration has been operating and, you know, what they're doing in terms of environmental regulations and safeguards. Right now, I think one of the big things that we are watching is what will happen in a couple different court processes. So last fall, permits were granted at the state level that are now being challenged by several different groups, including Sierra Club. So I don't want to talk too much about it, but we are continuing to really organize and make sure that people know the like issues of this pipeline and why it's so important that we stop it. It's a regional issue, and there are opportunities for decision makers, especially in Michigan right now, actually, to help ensure that we're protecting the Great Lakes from Line 5.
The EPA rollbacks, is that impacting the work, just the overall work of the Sierra Club?
That's a good question. I can't speak too much to specific details. Yeah. It hasn't been a big deal in my particular issues, which is certainly not to say that it's not a big deal. And I think that it also can be in the coming weeks and months and such. I think with Line 5, federally, there's so much uncertainty that we're really focusing in on, yeah, education work. We've got a new campaign called Fish for the Future, which we're really excited about, and just trying to pay attention to state-level decision makers.
Now, is the pipeline work Part of your being on the tar sands team. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. So our tar sands team is one of our volunteer teams. It's run jointly with 350 Wisconsin. And so we've got volunteers from all over the state that come in. We meet monthly and we talk about, you know, what's new and then how we can bring more people into this work, make it energizing and feel good to be doing the work that's really important to protect the water and climate and treaty rights.
You know, the in terms of the Sierra Club and the work you do, it's great to meet you and to see a younger face. When I think of the Sierra Club, for me, I'm thinking of, a lot of us older folks. Are you finding that when you're organizing campaigns and you're reaching out that you are able to motivate young people, and are they coming into this kind of work in a way that you feel hopeful about?
Definitely. It's been really cool. I've been in this role now about 5 years, and I feel like I've seen just like a huge range of people get involved. Obviously, there are lots of older folks who have time, and that's so appreciated. I work with such amazing volunteers who dedicate hours and hours each week, but there are some really wonderful younger volunteers. We have people engage really across like the entire age span, and I think especially with like fun and exciting activities, people are really excited to do something that feels positive, and it is also making an impact and like helping move some of these campaigns forward.
Yeah, and of course, not to suggest that people aren't interested, because I know there's some great even youth climate activists that are doing amazing things, fighting for the future. So I wanted to make sure that we talked about the campaign you were doing. What's going on now at Oak Creek?
That's a good question. There's so much moving there right now.
What's the issue there for folks?
Yeah, so to give some background, Oak Creek is the location of this massive power plant infrastructure hosted by We Energies. They're a major utility in Wisconsin, the most profitable utility here, actually. And despite their profits, there are serious concerns about their customers' rates, which are really high, particularly in Black and Latinx neighborhoods in Milwaukee. And given all of this and, you know, the climate crisis that we're in, We Energies has still been proposing new gas infrastructure, including at Oak Creek, where they want to build a new, very large gas plant. I think there's a lot of like questions that float around like, what is natural gas? Is it better? Is it not? I think on our end, we're saying, you know, natural gas is the same thing as gas. It's the same thing as methane gas. It's the same thing as fossil gas. It's a fossil fuel and has serious concerns for, you know, health and climate and cost. And so we've been pushing back and trying to advocate for cleaner solutions and not more fossil fuel infrastructure in Oak Creek.
And so at this point, can we say you've pushed back pretty successfully on it?
Yeah, I think that there's still outstanding decisions. So, of course, want people to be engaged as decision makers are making those, you know, considerations. But recently there was massive turnout. Hundreds of people packed a room in Oak Creek in Oak Creek in opposition to this new gas plant. Not everybody was able to talk. The hearing was cut short at the end of the night because the building was closing, and it was clear that almost everybody there was in opposition to the project.
At the Sierra Club of Wisconsin chapter, you can learn more about gas because there is a lot out there to suggest otherwise, that it can be, that it's clean. At the website, you can see a recent study from the Union of Concerned Scientists about gas plants.
Yeah, we've got some really great information online and some really amazing partners who have been doing great work. So I would encourage everybody to take a look and learn some more. Utilities love to do their greenwashing, and it's important for us to be knowledgeable.
Can you talk about the organizing? Because part of your work as a campaign coordinator is to organize, right? And, you know, you're also working with the tribes, nations, right? Can you talk about just the the communities you're organizing with on the ground?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think the area that we work very closely on with tribes that I'm most involved in is on our Line 5 work. Obviously, this is a regional issue. It's a national issue, but really importantly, it is an issue that impacts Wisconsin's tribes in the Shawangunk Bay area. The Bad River Band and Red Cliff have both been very involved in this work. And we have done a lot of work organizing folks locally together to make sure people know really why it's so important to be taking a stand against Line 5.
Do you have representatives of tribes? You have faith community people? You have local people around the communities around the pipeline?
Yeah, there's a really amazing spread of people who are involved. Everybody that you've mentioned, we've also got like health groups. We have people who are anglers and fishers really concerned about spawning grounds and things like that. We've got farmers, people from just every sector and interest you can think of that are really concerned about the impact that this pipeline would have if it continued to operate.
Now, is there, right now, it's I guess it's not clear the urgency of this. Something could happen by executive order, who knows? But are you concerned about that? Are you prepared for
having
to move quickly?
We've been tracking, everything that's going on at the executive level, federal level, and also know that, court processes, regulatory processes take a while for a reason. It's important to have a really strong environmental review. And we want to make sure that that happens. We've seen Enbridge's behavior in other areas and in Wisconsin, where we just recently last fall had a huge spill. A couple years ago in Minnesota, Enbridge was doing construction on the Line 3 pipeline there and punctured aquifers, had frackouts, which is where drilling fluid is released to the surrounding environment. And so we're, really concerned about that. And it points to the need for really strong environmental reviews that are going to require time to do.
So, kind of recapping, because we went all over the state. Mm-hmm. We're talking about Oak Creek, we're talking about Line 5. And is the issue in Superior, is that a separate issue?
Yes.
Okay. So we'll go up north.
Yeah. Okay.
Far north.
For folks who are listening, there's so much going on.
Yeah.
Always happy to answer questions if you all are interested in learning more. In Superior, we've been really watching closely the proposed Nemadji Trail Energy Center, or NTEC. This is a new proposed gas plant from Dairyland Power in Wisconsin, along with some other partners in other states. And we are super concerned that, again, similar to with Oak Creek, there's new gas infrastructure that is going to lock customers into higher rates and paying for that fossil fuel infrastructure for decades, when clean energy right now is already cheaper. So we've been working with also a wonderful coalition of partners and other folks who have been pushing back against that project.
And how would you describe that effort that you organized and you're ready to push back on any licensing development or?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'd say that there's been, huge successes. It's been really clear that the Superior community is against the project with opposition from the city council. And there's a wonderful group of local folks and neighbors who have really been speaking out against this. And I think that if, anything else comes up, we're ready to push back and make sure that this plant doesn't get built.
We do know what some of the consequences on health are from living in proximity to a gas plant, right? So there's not just the climate issues, right? Can you talk about, already in Wisconsin, what we know and why we should be concerned about the health impacts of gas plants?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there have been more and more studies coming out that look at the impacts of living near gas infrastructure. you know, similar to a lot of things that we were seeing with coal, there are concerns around like asthma, heart and lung disease, et cetera. There are numerous different health impacts of these fossil fuels. And that's on top of the concern of how increased climate change impacts, you know, like extreme weather, whether that's intense heat, which is a big concern for anybody who doesn't have access to like air conditioning, extreme cold without heating, or major storms. And those all impact people's health in a really negative way.
You know, rural communities, you know, really do need our support in, you know, bringing power, you know, reliable power. And there were opportunities in the last administration to invest in that. How do we have any updates on, you know, the status of that? I a lot of the funding coming from the Inflation Reduction Act, I know they're clawing back funding that under this administration.
Yeah, so I think right now there's a lot of question marks. We are really hoping to see funding come through. In Wisconsin, especially, the Dairyland Power Cooperative, which is the utility that, again, was proposing NTEC and Superior, received a new AERA grant, which is part of the Inflation Reduction Act, and that's for clean energy, which was a big ask. There are a lot of local rural folks in the cooperative electric cooperative system who were advocating for that funding to come through to support cleaner and safer electric infrastructure for them. So we're really hoping to see that come through. Definitely a lot of question marks right now. Yeah.
You know, the things come into focus. There's so many moving parts, and can certainly, by clawing back, if so, the Inflation Reduction Act funding, just like they are. I was reading one of the paper this morning about the infrastructure bill, you know, that they can clear the way for other kinds of projects and investors. So, wow. Thank you for reminding me about this moving part, because it's just happening and we're looking at so many things, and this is so important to think about clean, sustainable energy in rural communities. You know.
Definitely. Yeah.
I'm speaking with Jadine Sanada. She is a campaign coordinator at the Sierra Club of Wisconsin chapter, their member agency of Community Shares Wisconsin. So can you just tell folks where they can get more information, how they can join? And also, you know, outings is on your mission, and Sierra Club always has good outings, right?
Yes. Yes, I would love for anybody listening to come learn more and get involved. If you go to our website, we have a tab for volunteering. We've also got pages on all of the issues we cover and the local groups that do work across the state. So you're welcome to reach out to any and all staff. We've got a wonderful volunteer coordinator, Heather Whitrock, and we can help you get up to speed and get involved in any way that you wish. Our goal is to help people learn and grow their advocacy and do that organizing work on a time frame that works for them. So we'd love to have you, whatever capacity you're able to bring.
And I'll direct people to the website as well. And to, I guess it's a calendar of events. And there is a lot going on, especially as we get closer to Earth Day. And just to, I just want to say these words because they're music to my ears. Madison Bird and Nature Festival Tabling. that's the Madison Bird and Nature Festival. But check that out, because in addition to these kinds of outings, there's also hearings that people can share their viewpoints.
Yeah, there's lots coming up, especially in the next couple of weeks. There are so many different ways for you all to get involved and to learn more, on pretty much every issue we cover.
So check that out. And I think this would be in 2 weeks, a budget hearing, Speak Up for Public Lands, Public Transit, Water and Wildlife. There's 2 days of a public hearings scheduled. And you know, actually, I didn't expect to see so much on this calendar. So would want to direct folks to it. Hey, Jadine, it's great to meet you. And tell folks why you do this work.
Yeah, I feel like I grew up when climate change was already something people knew about. As a kid, I remember, my uncle took me to this little bookstore and I bought a little book on the climate equation or something like that, kind of trying to figure out your carbon footprint. But climate change has been something that I've grown up with, and I think that that work and justice work is really, really important. And it's, I think can be really energizing in a way to build community and do so many good things while protecting all of ourselves and providing care work to the community.
So good to meet you. Jadine Sanada, campaign coordinator at the Wisconsin chapter of the Sierra Club. And the Sierra Club is a member agency of Community Shares Wisconsin. That just zoomed by, Jadine. Thank you for coming in.
Did. Thank you for having me.
We're going to take a short break, and then coming back will be Marco Aguirre joining me. So stay with us.
I don't need no doctor, 'cause I know what's in me.
Hey, good music, Dave. Joining me is Marco Aguirre, a member of Madison-Arkansas Sister City Project, an American citizen originating from El Salvador. Aguirre continues to stay closely in touch with Salvadoran politics through a variety of media and personal connections, and wanted to talk with him today about to take a deeper view of U.S.-El Salvador relations and the crisis it represents. So, hey, good morning, Marco. Thank you for joining me.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Hey, so, you know, I want to jump right into Monday. We'll start there. Your key kind of takeaways, your observations from the meeting in the Oval Office, the President of the United States and President Bukele of El Salvador. What did you see? What were you listening for? And, you know, what was that all about?
There were a lot of things to be looking for and a lot of things to be concerned about in that meeting. I was watching it as it was happening, and I do have to say I wasn't too surprised. Although I did hear confirmation of some of my biggest fears. I think I've been paying close attention to it because, first of all, it's the place where I was born, El Salvador, and the place where I live now, the U.S., are clearly in close relationship with this effort to incarcerate people in what's probably some of the worst conditions in the world as far as human rights go, as far as conditions go. And so it is very concerning to see the president of El Salvador meeting the president of the U.S. and talk about how the next steps will be sending U.S. citizens back to the max security prison where they're currently are hosting a lot of people that are innocent of any crime and that have no recourse under any law to be let out.
The presentation, the photo op in the Oval Office for you people in the U.S., and lots of folks really are having a superficial understanding of what this is about. But for folks who are in El Salvador knowing that President Bukele was in Washington, what was that for?
For folks who are in El Salvador, they clearly see this has been something that's been going on for a while. The El Salvador government had been lobbying the Biden administration to be able to be invited to the White House. That was not something that happened in the previous administration, but there's something that happened this week. And the main efforts were Bukele managed to reelect himself in El Salvador, even though El Salvador constitution doesn't allow reelection. El Salvador president is looking for validity, for legitimacy on his reelection as a legitimate second term president, even though it's illegal as El Salvador's constitution to be reelected. So that's his angle. That's his main purpose, is to be seen as a legitimate president in international eyes.
And then how does it impact Americans here in the U.S. To see that validation?
Well, I think the biggest, and what I was mentioning earlier, there's a lot of consequences to that for Salvadorians. However, for U.S. For the U.S. and for people here in the U.S., I think the biggest consequences is genuinely this notion and this idea that America has to be shaped in the way that El Salvador has been shaped in the past 6-7 years. And by that, I mean a complete disregard for the Constitution, complete disregard for civil rights that have been upheld in this country for a long, long time.
So the mega prisons, they're holding thousands of people. Talk about that. Mm-hmm. Concern.
Yeah. So this is the main angle that I think people from this country should be concerned about. This is the main thing that I really would like for people to understand, even if they're not paying attention on a day-to-day basis, even if they don't really pay attention to any politics. But El Salvador holds in their mega prison, which has been lately getting popular because of Venezuelans being deported there. The mega prison is called CECOT, which is a max security prison in which was built in the past 4 years. And its main purpose is to imprison anybody who, under any suspicion, in El Salvador, under any suspicion of being a gang member, gang associate, or person who anybody accuses of any wrongdoing will end up in. There is absolutely no process in which people can be guaranteed to be taken out. It is just a place where you go with a guarantee of being stuck there for an indefinite amount of time.
So there are human rights concerns that folks, that the vast majority, I mean, tens and tens, almost 100,000 people, just a small fraction have even been charged with things. Is that correct?
A large majority of them haven't been charged.
Yes.
And a good number of them who have been charged were charged under this new law that allows judges to condemn people on a non-individual basis. And by that, I mean 80, 100, 150 people will be accused of a single crime, and they will all be found guilty on evidence that might not pertain to you, might not pertain to anybody except for one person in the trial.
So Mark, if I'm not following up on something that's important, please do. But I did have a couple of things that I really wanted to discuss this morning. So there's a popular appeal though in El Salvador for this kind of law enforcement. Can you talk about why that might be and something about the root causes of the violence there?
Yeah, so I think one of the first things that I should say is that there's a lot of autocrats that are popular in their countries. Pinochet was very popular and still remains popular. El Salvador is no different. Yes. In that regard, because because violence and El Salvador had been plagued by violence for 20 years. If you look back at the roots of that gang violence, it all stems from the deportations from the California and the LA area, where a lot of refugees from the El Salvador Civil War came to. And a lot of the children of those immigrants were basically learned the way of the gangs in LA. And instead of paying for whatever crime they might have committed in the LA area, they were deported to El Salvador. El Salvador at that point had just come out of the Civil War. And all these people who came just did the same thing that they learned in the LA streets. And that was create gangs, create structures to continue on their way of living, which was committing crimes, extorting people, and just petty crimes in general. Now, that structure, that organization that they created continued to get bigger. And this is what had plagued El Salvador and El Salvador society for 20 years before Bukele came to power. This made an increasing desperation and need for some sort of solution. Bukele offered that solution. And like many autocrats, the solution was to take rights away in exchange of security. And that is not very different to what, like I said, a lot of authoritarian governments do. And basically, in El Salvador, we are in this constant what is called a state of exception. And that means the police and the army can enter your home without any warrant. They can imprison you without any warrant from any judge of any kind, and you have no recourse once you're in prison. And a lot of people found that it worked, and that anybody who was part of a gang, anybody who was associated with a gang ended up in jail. But along with them, a lot of innocent people also ended up in jail. And so it is popular in the sense that people saw the gang members get out of the street. People saw the people who were getting extorted basically going to jail. And that's why there is popularity in that aspect of security, and people find that is way better to have streets without gangs than to have security.
So the Civil War, and can you just, many of our listeners understand this, but can you talk about the U.S. relationship with El Salvador during the Civil War?
Yeah, absolutely. I think I was trying to summarize in big terms, just, you know, the trajectory of the country. But El Salvador during the 80s and started in the 70s, El Salvador had a lot of influence, and El Salvador was just basically one of those places where the actual proxy wars were fought. And by that, I mean the Soviet Union was supporting guerrillas in El Salvador, and the U.S. decided to support authoritative government in Latin America. El Salvador was one of those places. So the U.S. sent massive amounts of money and massive amounts in the form of weapons and bombs, and was fighting basically Salvadorian basically farmers, Salvadorian poor people in their struggle to try to gain rights, in their struggle to try to gain recognition. And so the U.S. and the reason why Madison, Arcatao's sister city, exists is as a way to make that struggle visible. And for the people of Madison who came and created that connection with Salvadorian people, it allowed them to say, these are the victims of the U.S. funding a war. And these are the victims of basically fighting wars that are completely unjustified. And these are the victims of the things that we are funding.
So there are, and then the other context I want to have you take time to discuss is that there are about 20 families that control most of the wealth, the vast majority of wealth. They control the land. And so it's talk about that piece. And there's some, you know, natural resources that are important to the United States, I imagine.
Yeah, so El Salvador, and you know, this goes back to 100 years of U.S. influence in El Salvador, but El Salvador was originally controlled by 14 families. Those were the wealthiest families in the country. It has been somewhat expanded to be 20 or so. But these people are, and in El Salvador, most people will know a lot of the last names of people who are just completely wealthy and they just own most of the land. This all comes from an era where El Salvador was producing coffee and was producing things for the U.S. And those people basically got their land taken away because most of the land was owned by native people from El Salvador of Mayan descent. And these 14 families just became enriched by the fact that they just passed a law that said they could take over any land that wasn't being used. And so these 14 families have, for the most part, for most of El Salvador history, owned anything that El Salvador produces. And most people have had to be working under them. And the reason for the Civil War really was for these people to get rights, because most of the time they were just being charged to even live in the land that they once owned, to just exist in that part of the country that once theirs. And so a lot of El Salvador has lived through mostly an oligarchy form of government for most of its existence. And what the current government has done is, even though the past 10, 15 years was a struggle to recover some of those rights, was a struggle to get people some of their rights, the current government has basically decided to become part of those 14 families and say, and reaffirm their status, reaffirm the owning of land, the owning of any sort of wealth generation. The U.S., I think, from the U.S. perspective, as far as resources is concerned, El Salvador is not very rich in much. However, there has been a push for gold mining happening in El Salvador, which is a huge danger to the water resources for such a small country. But I think currently, as far as the U.S. is concerned, El Salvador is seen more as a place where criminals can be dumped, which is not very different to the way it was seen 20, 30 years ago when criminals were deported back to a country that was just torn by civil war.
Yes. And can you talk about the conditions for people who are really dispossessed, don't live on their ancestors' land, they're working for these oligarchs? Can you talk about the conditions?
Yeah, so El Salvador is a very small country. El Salvador has very little farmable land. And El Salvador has been considered as a developing country for a long time. And even though there's a lot of propaganda saying to people that this is now a safe, wonderful place to visit, El Salvador has been plagued by inequalities that are still present to this day. Argatao, which is the sister city, the Madison sister city, is a perfect example of a place that is a tiny town in the middle of the mountains, and a lot of the land is really non-farmable, and the ways for a lot of the rural people to subsist is very tiny. Like, there's not that many opportunities. A lot of people have to be able to make a living, have to travel to towns that are slightly larger. But most people live under $300 a month. A lot of people will try to sell fruit and vegetables to their neighbors. But the large majority of people will be living under very, very poor conditions.
So because of history, and you know, just this ongoing dispossession, is it fair to say that there's many, you know, with that historical memory, are really active grassroots organizers?
Yeah, absolutely. We have a lot of people, even in a small town like Arcatao, which is a few thousand people. We have many people who've learned to organize, who've learned to create spaces so that everybody can have a voice. I grew up going to Arcatao as a child, and I learned a lot from just the locals, from just seeing that struggle. We constantly have, as much as we can, as much as the U.S. Embassy will allow us, have people from Arcatao and from El Salvador come to Madison so they can speak about the way they organize, so they can speak about the way that they manage to get their voice out.
You know, one of the takeaways I had when last year I got to meet some visitors from El Salvador who were organizers is organizing across boundaries as well, right? That was impressive.
Yeah, it is. It is genuinely, I mean, I think that's one of the most important parts that we can learn is how even though their condition, sometimes it feels in this country like we can't do much when we're facing such large hurdles. And I think El Salvador and the people from El Salvador who are struggling, who keep resisting the conditions they live in and everything they had to go through, is that we can learn a lot from them, and we can learn that organizing is very important, and that being active and being a part of a much larger thing matters a lot.
You know, the kind of circling back to the mega prisons, you know, and the, you know, using El Salvador as a penal colony. Who owns the mega prisons, and can you, do we know, you know, are they making a lot of money?
So in El Salvador, the mega prison was built. One of the hardest things about El Salvador and about being informed about El Salvador is that because the current president has very much absolute power, a lot of the transparency laws were basically shut down. So a lot of the things, we don't know precise details on who owns and who administers them. But on paper, the government built and administers the mega prison. Now those prisons, because like I said, because there's no rights for any of the prisoners, a lot of the time they're forced into labor. And the money that's generated from that forced labor, there's been reports from El Salvador newspapers that the money generated is going into the basically the inner circle of the current president. So it isn't just about administering it like it would be in the U.S., where people get rich from administering prisons and prisoners. It's a lot about slave labor and the fruits of that slave labor going into the hands of people who are already wealthy.
And that PR photos with everybody looking well-fed and clean, what do you think of that?
I mean, if you look at the, and I have been looking at these for a long time, but if you look at the pictures of the prisoners in El Salvador, and almost anything that comes out of El Salvador these days, everything will be retouched and manicured to make it look and get a message across the way they want you to think of it. And there has been people who have been released from the prison who will tell you that the conditions are not good. Not just not good, but they're like very much torture. It is very much a fact that El Salvador prisons there are people who are tortured, there are people who are disappeared, and there are people who are not treated in the least humane way possible.
Yeah, it's such a PR presentation when you see that. And you know, I'm speaking with Marco Aguirre, a member of the Madison Arcatel Sister City Project, and just wanting to get his viewpoint, an American citizen with who stays closely in touch with Salvadoran politics, and to, you know, just get have a deeper discussion about the seriousness of the U.S. El Salvador relationship and, you know, the crisis it represents. Hey, Marco, that time went by so quickly. I'm so grateful that you were with me this morning. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Hey, Dave, we're just going to go now to the Wart news piece from last evening. The protesters staging attacks, they sit in at the state capitol.
The second level of the Wisconsin Capitol Rotunda is a mosaic depicting the concept of legislation as portrayed by a Greek godlike figure. Today, underneath this imagery, a small gathering of protesters set up shop with signs, flags, and literature on community building and outreach resources. And the sit-in isn't over. PJ Chamberlain is the outreach coordinator at the Community Pharmacy Cooperative. He was one of the organizers of today's events.
We're kind of protesting all the systems that have, like, really damaged our community and led to people, like, really needing to depend on resources that are being taken away, and hoping to connect people with resources that are still here and that are provided by the community. And then, you know, later on we're going to be doing some speeches from local groups about the theme, and then doing a candlelight vigil march just to memorialize, you know, the people we've lost to the gears of capitalism, and then just even things that are going on as an entire country right now. You know, it's really frustrating, and I think coming together as a community is one of the best ways we can support each other.
If you walked by the Capitol on the State Street side, you may have also seen the mural being painted in front of the Lady Forward statue as part of the protest. Inside, items provided at the sit-in table included pamphlets for local nonprofit groups, zines about knowing your rights at a protest, and physical resources, things like Narcan, reusable straws, and emergency contraceptives.
We have stuff from all over. I tried to gather directly from some places. Some places have dropped off stuff. I've printed off information that places have had on their website or social media. So I have stuff from all sorts of places. I hate to leave anything out, but like we have the Gender and Sexuality Campus Center, Sex Out Loud. We have stuff from Patient Protector. We have stuff from the UW Center for Cooperatives, from the Center for Patient Partnerships, Black Men's Coalition, Progress Center for Black Women, ACLU of Wisconsin, Room of One's Own.
The resources being provided are shared with a goal in mind, connecting the community to protect each other from the harms of capitalism and the current administration. But Chamberlain says disturbance isn't the only goal of protest.
You know, it's a protest, but it's also about community building, but that is definitely an act of protest. You know, it's about empowering people and giving them the knowledge to both support themselves and each other and defend each other.
Other members of the sit-in shared this sentiment.
Going out and yelling and shouting and protesting, doing like the rally in the streets, like there are other ways that we can make a difference, and I think that this is an important one. Like doing sit-ins is like a very classic form of protest and can be very powerful.
That was Beverly, another protester who was there for the long haul. The group was small but dedicated. They were inspired to come today in different ways.
You know, I've lost about 8 friends in the last 10 years, and a lot of it I could, you know, say is connected back with capitalism.
I think in our modern political climate, capitalism and neoliberalism have completely failed us, and they're leaving us behind in many ways. Like, in, for example, healthcare, renting costs in Madison are absolutely outrageous, and I could go on, but I don't need to because I'm sure that anyone who's listening can think of many examples that personally relate to them.
My understanding of capitalism is that, you know, there are capital elite folks who have a lot of wealth and control the way that the labor that people put into our economy, they extract all that value out. And yeah, I'm here in resistance as like a common person who wants to make sure that everyone's needs are still met.
And that is from the Tuesday WORT Evening News. Check it out because there's some additional information at the end of the story on the protests this weekend. Hey, thank you to Dave Lawrence, our music producer and engineer, Miss Tina, our receptionist. I'm Jan Miyasaki, and I will talk with you next week.
And it's 9 o'clock. You're listening to WORT 89.9 FM, Madison. Stay tuned. The Surgeon Radio Kiosk, and then Art's going to take us back to the country, so stay tuned.
This is the Insurgent Radio Kiosk for Wednesday, April 16th.
This is Bird Note. Birds' eggs are among nature's most elegant creations, but they're not easy to make. This American robin will lay one egg per day for 3 to 4 days. To make her eggs, the female robin has to use a great deal of calcium. But she can't just pour herself a nice big glass of milk. She has to find her calcium in nature. And it can be tough to find enough. But we can help. During the nesting season, we can give the birds that visit our homes some of that crucial calcium. Start off by putting calcium-enriched seed and suet in your bird feeders. For the many species that don't eat seed or suet, like robins, you can give them leftover chicken eggshells instead. Rinse the shells off in the sink, spread them out on a cookie sheet, and bake them in the oven at about 250 degrees for 10 minutes. You just want the shells to dry, not brown. When you're done, crush them up. Crushed eggshells can be mixed with birdseed and set out in a feeding tray or scattered right on